Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WVUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've all seen the bumper sticker, "Practice Random Acts of Kindness." That may be easier said than done. In a society where doing well takes precedence over doing good, kindness seems to be in short supply. Our guest today, Adam Phillips, would even argue that we're afraid of kindness, wary of it, that it's become dangerous to practice. This hour on Point, kindness, how we lost it, and the case for bringing it back. You can join the conversation. Do you consider kindness a strength or a weakness? Are you as kind as you'd like to be? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is Adam Phillips, co-author of the book On Kindness and a practicing psychotherapist in London. Adam Phillips, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
And with me in the studio here is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome to you, Jack.
Hello, Jane. Hello, Mr. Phillips.
So, Adam, you examine the pleasures and the perils of kindness. Set the table for us in this conversation. Give us a working definition, to your mind, of kindness.
Well, I think it derives from its original meaning, which is of the same kind. So that acts of kindness would be acts in which we make fundamental sympathetic identifications with other people. I mean, if just by way of illustration, let's pretend, broadly speaking, there are two kinds of people. There are people who are sympathetic and people who need to be right. So if you're walking down the street with your child and your child falls over, the sympathetic person will immediately feel for the child and feel something of the child's pain. The person who needs to be right will say, "You should have looked where you were going." Hmm. Now, kindness is obviously on the side of that kind of sympathetic identification. But in actually identifying with a child who's hurt himself, you have to suffer a lot of things. It brings you closer to the child, but you actually might find yourself feeling some of that child's pain. So it's something to do with an identification with other people's vulnerabilities and their strengths and pleasures.
Has that original definition changed? Has it evolved, to your mind, over time, especially in recent years?
I think so. I mean, I think that we try and sketch, rather schematically, because it's deliberately a brief book, a history of kindness. And of course, it's changed over time, partly because our picture of what a human being is has changed over time. And it's not that the book is saying we have become less kind, because it's very difficult to know whether that's true or not. It's that kindness becomes a problem when self-interest is privileged. So that the more we live in a culture in which we are encouraged to succeed, to compete, to triumph, we're less able to be kind without feeling that it's a kind of weakness.
So is that the basis for your argument in the book that today we're afraid of kindness, that we're wary of it, that as I said in the introduction, that it's become sort of a forbidden pleasure?
Yes, I think there's a cultural ethos that makes it very, very difficult to be as kind as we might want to be. I mean, the book starts from a very simple experience, really, which I think everybody has, which is that everybody feels that they're not as kind as they would like to be. And everybody feels very acutely the unkindness of other people. In other words, it's a very common grievance that we feel people are not as kind to us as they should be. So the question is, why would there be an inhibition on kindness? If actually it's a pleasure, if when we are kind we are actually happier, what stops us being as kind as we would like to be? Well, the book says there might be at least two reasons for this. One is that actually, when we're being kind to other people, it involves us with other people. Mm. It actually brings us closer to other people. So that could be an anxiety. The other anxiety is that when we're kind to other people, we have to, in a way, by acknowledging someone else's vulnerability, acknowledge our own. Mm. So there's going to be a part of ourselves that wants a world without vulnerability. If you want a world without vulnerability in it, you have to drop kindness.
Jack Beattie, what was your take on the book, On Kindness?
Well, while reading this eclectic and surprising book, I was put in mind of a scene from Brian De Palma's movie, The Untouchables, in which Sean Connery, playing an Irish cop in Chicago, goes into his apartment, and there's a man there with a knife who comes at him, and Sean Connery has a shotgun and blows him away, and he says, "Ah, that's just like your Italian. He comes to a gunfight with a knife." And I feel like I came to this gunfight with a knife. I expected the Christians. I expected Seneca and the Stoics. I look forward to my old friend Adam Smith and the feeling of sociability. And I anticipated and was rewarded with a thorough thrashing of capitalism. But what surprised me and what comes out of left field and made me think this is a gunfight after all is this sort of thing. And, of course, we remember that Mr. Phillips is a psychoanalyst. This is from Donald Winnicott, a British psychoanalyst. I'll just quote, "I suggest that the mother hates the baby before the baby hates the mother, and before the mother can know before the baby can know his mother hates him." And I felt like saying, what's this doing in a book on kindness?
So explain, Adam Phillips, this kindness going back to mothers?
Well, the book, which obviously has no reference to Sean Connery in it, the book is saying something very simple. It's not naively saying, let's try and be kinder than we are. It's saying that we are profoundly ambivalent animals, that we both love and hate. Indeed, that a kindness divorced from hatred would be simply sentimental. So when Winnicott says the mother hates the baby before the baby hates the mother, he's saying something very, very simple, which is that despite or as well as the mother's passion for her child, the mother is also often frightened of the baby, also feels she can't satisfy the baby. In other words, actually having a baby, and I don't speak on behalf of women because I've never had a baby myself, but my sense of this is that it's very difficult for mothers to be allowed to feel as ambivalent as they do about their children, because the cultural pressure says mothers must love children. So mothers are not allowed to be ambivalent. Whereas when you have a baby, your body's invaded, your life is taken over, and you are taken over. It would be very odd for a mother, however loving she was, not to feel sometimes a hatred of the baby.
So this goes to the notion of kindness as a duty, or rather than perhaps a desire sometimes.
Yes, that what spoils kindness is when the pleasure of kindness is turned into a duty or a command. Because what we're saying is not, you must try harder to be kind. Everybody says that. We're saying something simpler, which is that actually, because kindness is a pleasure, it becomes repressed. That actually we need to be freed to be kinder, not told to be kind. Because when we start enacting the idea of being kind, or start doing it as a dutiful act, we hate doing it. Hmm. It's not a pleasure.
When did kindness shift from being an essential virtue, as you say in the book, to the competitive sort of notion of looking out for oneself?
It's very difficult to say, and I don't think we've got a strong idea about that. And we have to talk schematically in the book because it's brief. But I think there is a sense that in, let's say, the 18th century, when there is the beginnings of the rise of capitalism and of a commercialist culture, then that a culture like that, in order for people to survive and succeed in it, is going to cultivate certain virtues over others. Now, I don't think that, as it were, overnight people became less kind, or necessarily they were tremendously kind beforehand. But what we do know is that if the culture is competitive, people can't afford too much kindness.
Once you stress competitiveness over collaboration, you lose the inclination to be kind.
Yes, or the pleasures of kindness have to be repressed. Mm-hmm. You have to set aside your kinder instincts in the service of a higher aim. And if you live in a culture that doesn't make a strong, eloquent case for other values beyond success, wealth, etc., then all the things that are not covered by the capitalist virtues are going to have to be set aside.
Yes, and as you point out, often set aside, feminized, made the province of women. Lesser
things. Put somewhere else. So if we want to look for kindness now, we look for it between mothers and children, between parents and children, that being the last bastion where kindness is an absolute necessity. I mean, no one's saying it'd be much better if mothers were cruel.
Let's go to the phones because we have many calls lined up already to Beaufort, South Carolina first. Raphael is on the line. Raphael, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call, man. I do appreciate it.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment that it is very true that like me personally, I really stopped actually doing acts of kindness and especially in this field and the business that I'm in. It's when you're kind, you're greatly manipulated, and then when you're manipulated, it feels like you're being shafted. And then when that happens, like, you get pushed behind. And then so now I have to revert all the way back to getting to where I need to be. And so in this culture, and it's very true, but personally, in my business, I have to brush that aside, because if I do act acts of kindness, it prevents me from my goal in my business, and then people start thinking that kindness is weakness, and then they try to start using you, and then you have to be on your game again. So it's more of this shark effect that I really don't like, and that's the reason why I kind of brushed it aside. And also my past experience, the more kindness I've done, the more people have used me and manipulated me, and I just kind of like shun that off now. I'm just starting to focus on me and focus on my business and my work.
Raphael, thanks. Adam Phillips, kindness is actually a weakness, certainly for Raphael in the workplace.
Yes, I mean, it's a serious point. And in a way, you could say our book is addressed to people who've had that kind of experience, which I think is very common, which is that in a culture that doesn't value kindness, kindness, when it is actually enacted, is going to be exploited. And so the trouble is that the person who does the kind act then actually feels quite confounded. Because on the one hand, they think, well, it's very clear, I can't afford to be kind. And yet the kind part of themselves is the part of themselves they value very highly. So that then I think there's a real internal confusion, because then you're left feeling one of the best things about yourself is the thing that is least valuable to you, indeed might even endanger you. Now that's the way, I think, to drive people crazy.
Yes, and you also, as you point out, from the disciplines of suspicion, like psychoanalysis, we all tend to think that our kindness is manipulative too, that our own kindness, we write it down as, oh, we're just trying to get sex or get someone's favor. We don't understand it as a primary human expression.
Yes, and I think one of the reasons we've lost confidence in it is precisely because it is so exploitable. That in a world in which people are doing deals, the question's always going to be, well, what's the deal in kindness?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing kindness this hour and whether or not there's enough of it to go around. I'm joined this hour by Adam Phillips, British psychotherapist and the author of the new treatise called On Kindness. Also joining me is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Jack brings up an interesting point, Adam, about the cultural differences as it relates to kindness. You are British. Here we are in America. What are the cultural differences to your mind as it relates to this topic?
I'm not sure I can answer that, and maybe Jack could better than I. I think that I suppose we write our book probably out of a sort of socialist communitarian tradition, broadly speaking, which I suppose would originally have been a version of Christianity. So that I think that even though we're trying to find a secular version of kindness, which has its own history in this country, it would originally be to do with religious differences, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And as you bring out, you talk about Lord Beveridge and the Beveridge Report, which inaugurated the British welfare state. And in that report, Beveridge draws a distinction between the welfare state and the thing that it's opposite to, which is the warfare state.
Yeah.
Alas, America remains a warfare state. And we are now, just now, with a president who talks about the deficit in this country of social empathy. We're just now trying to get something like our own national health after these many, many 60, 70 years after you did. If we're not quite at a communitarian turn, we're at a point where the old nostrums, the old individualism, feels to many people played out, and it feels with the headlines, the disgraces on Wall Street, these financial crimes, it seems to be connected to great financial crime, that maybe there's a better way. So I think your book is well-timed in that respect, but I do think there is that big difference, the welfare state, which is a bad word in America, versus the warfare state. And in America, that's what we do. We do war.
Adam, you mentioned...
Yes,
no, go ahead, please, respond.
I was going to say, I mean, when I was asked the question, I thought of the National Health Service. And I suppose the National Health Service was based on the belief that that a culture which allowed too great a disparity of wealth was going to inevitably be excessively conflictual. So that if fundamental things like education and health were not looked after in the way one might look after them in a family, this could only lead to a great deal of cultural conflict. So that there were, as were pragmatic and humane reasons why a National Health Service would matter. Now, one of the things the Health Service stood up for was the idea that, a very simple idea, which is everybody gets ill. That simply to be a person is to be very vulnerable. And if a state is going to have any significance other than simply stopping people killing each other, its other value could be a more maternal and paternal version of itself, which would be actually concerned for the welfare of individuals. The idea being, I think, somewhere, even though this is not explicitly stated, that the people who are extremely wealthy or successful are somewhere also feeling the guilt about this, that there's no such thing as a free profit, that somewhere people are suffering from the fact that if they are wealthier than other people, they have exploited more people. That somebody suffers if somebody gains. It's a very simple point. We didn't need Marx to tell us this. So that where there is exploitation, there is guilt. Now, the only way guilt is managed in this in a culture like this is one in which it's turned into a kind of triumphal exhilaration. In other words, I am tremendously exempt from my feeling for other people. Because without that exhilaration, the whole thing collapses very, very quickly.
Here's a call from...
Because one of the things about, I suppose, one of the things about kindness that I suppose I want to stress is that people are very much are moved by many more people than they sexually desire. That kindness is much more, for want of a better word, promiscuous than sexuality actually is. And I think that because people feel actually so powerfully and instinctively for other people, that in itself mobilizes great defenses against that feeling. So people need to work very, very hard not to feel for other people's vulnerabilities. And it's the defenses against that that then become the problem. People become inured and then self-estranged.
Let me go to the phones here for a moment, get some of our callers, our listeners in here who'd like to join this. Leah is calling from Fort Myers, Florida. Leah, welcome to On Point.
I just want to comment on a statement that was made early on that nobody is kind, and I strongly disagree with that. You know, people where I live, and I'm sure other places, practice random acts of kindness. It's not unusual for me to pull up Starbucks in the morning to find the person in front of me has paid for my coffee. Or I go through a toll booth and I'll pay the toll for the person behind me. I don't do it for what I'm going to get other than just the joy of doing it. Or if I have a friend or a coworker short of cash, just sticking money in their pocket when they're not watching. It's not for what you're getting. It's the feeling you get of doing something of value. And maybe it is cultural. I don't know. But I don't believe that kindness doesn't exist. I see it everywhere.
Leah, thank you.
I don't think we said on the program that kindness doesn't exist. But I think the examples you're giving are very good ones. That seems to me a picture of a very good life. The only issue would be, and I think this might be true of people who are very kind, would be to notice the ways in which there are situations in which one feels moved to be kind and one isn't kind. Now, those seem to me to be the interesting examples, because the kindness that flows easily is wonderful and clearly makes people's lives worth living. It's the moments where one is moved to kindness and doesn't act kindly that seem to me to be of interest.
Here's Philip. He's in Durham, North Carolina. Philip, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. In a world where, or a society where success is measured by, by money, then that makes it real easy for people to just become selfish and they're only worried about themselves. And whenever that happens, then of course they're not worried about other people. And I would suggest to you that. The act of our society being so influenced by insurance, meaning home insurance, car insurance, all those kind of things, adds to the fact that people forget about kindness, because if somebody's house burns down, they don't have to think about what that person's going to do or how that family's going to survive, because their insurance is supposed to take care of it. Where before there was insurance, then everybody pitched in to help those people who had tragedy in their life, not only because it was helping them and being kind, but also because they knew that if it happened to them, that those other people would reciprocate for them.
Yeah.
That's such an interesting point, Philip. Thanks so much for calling, Jack.
Yeah, and that point, of course, has been made again and again about social insurance. George Bush Sr., when he became president, he talked about the value of charity. He wanted a country where we didn't rely on the state to do all these things. He talked about 1,000 points of light that people would, revivify the old virtues of going to help the person and not let the state do it. But what about that point, Mr. Phillips, that social insurance in a way atrophies this instinct to help?
I think it's a very interesting point, because it seems to me it's as though the preoccupation with insurance and certain kind of safety is an acknowledgement implicitly that we're not living in a community. So we need to, as it were, make laws that guarantee that if something terrible happens to us, there is a mechanism in place that will look after us, because we can't assume other people will. Mm. And I think that you can institutionalize unkindness by calling it security. And I think it's very, very dangerous. I mean, I think the Bush thing is interesting for this reason. And I think the problem we're up against here is that, at least from my point of view, that people are actually so disturbed and horrified by other people's suffering that they have to transform it into something else. And one of the things they transform it into is a pleasure in other people's suffering at its worst, that somewhere it's being actually enjoyed, or it's being ignored. But actually, no one is immune to another person's suffering. We instinctively identify with other people. And it's all the ways in which we cure ourselves of that identification that becomes the problem.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Diane is in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Diane, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call,
sure.
Jane.
Mm-hmm.
We have sprawling suburbs around here, and it's hard for a lot of people that have to get to the city to ride the bus. And I often give people rides that I see when it's cold or raining or very hot, and people say I'm crazy, I'm going to get hurt. One morning, I saw the bus ride by a young guy who had all his uniform and gear, and he was plainly being deployed. He was on his way to, the base.
Mm-hmm.
So I stopped to ask him if he wanted a ride. I said, I saw the bus go by you. He was afraid to come to the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, come on and let me give you a ride. I'm going right by there. It's going to be another hour for another bus. So he finally reluctantly got in the car, and he just kept looking at me very suspiciously. And I said, I'm not going to hurt you. And he said, I hope not. And it really made me sad, because here was somebody getting ready to go to war halfway around the world, but he was afraid of somebody doing something kind for him in our own country. What's that about? Mm.
Diane, thank you. What a great call. Suspicion about kindness. The motives of somebody who is kind. Adam Phillips.
It is a very, very vivid example. And of course, one of the interesting things is why people are so frightened of each other. I mean, that would be a sort of fundamental question. I suppose the other bit is that's kind of acknowledged in the story is that it's also true that kindness is a risk. Because when you're kind to somebody, you are entrusting yourself to their response to your kindness. And of course, you could be kind and they could be violent back to you. So that the other thing that has to be put clearly in the picture, if we're going to have a realistic view of kindness rather than a sentimental one, is that actually kindness is a risk.
Does everyone deserve kindness, Adam Phillips?
I don't know what everybody deserves, but I think everybody should be treated as kindly as they can be. But I think in order for that to be a realistic proposition, we have to acknowledge what the lady just said, which is that people are very frightened of each other, and the more frightened of each other they are, the more violent they're going to be to each other. So it seems to me, in a way, that a man who's frightened of getting into someone's car would be a good person to go to war.
Here's a call from Lynnville, Virginia. Ken is on the line. Thanks for waiting, Ken. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to say was I agree with what was said a while ago about people being very leery of kindness. About 10 years ago, I volunteered to be I found out later it was the first person in the world to donate part of my liver to a stranger. And I spent more time actually with the psychiatrist trying to figure out why I wanted to do it than making sure that I could do it physically.
Hmm. And what did you determine? Why did you do it?
They determined finally at the end, they said that they found out some people just like to do good things.
Mm-hmm. That
was a total thing, and everything worked out just fine.
Turned out to be pretty simple. Adam Phillips, Ken, thanks for your call. Adam?
I mean, that seems to me a very powerful example thing we're talking about, which is if we are literally of the same kind, that's to say we have the same bodies at some level, then we are actually able to do that kind of thing. But in the doing of it, we might have all sorts of conflicts. You know, the question would be, as the gentleman said, why would I want to do this? Now, it seems to me I can imagine a world in which that wouldn't be a question, in which actually you would think, that's what I want to do.
Hmm. Yes. Wouldn't that be wonderful? A culture where that was the dominant motive. Adam, let me put another question to you. I can hear, a sort of modern person, self-consciously modern person, saying, what about authenticity? And they'd say, they might look at a scene, for example, like the scene in Emma, Jane Austen's Emma, where at a picnic, Miss Bates, the addle-pated Miss Bates, who just prattles on about everything, prattles on to the vexation of Emma, who just puts her down and basically says, you're an addle-pate. You're just talking to fill the air. And Mr. Knightley takes her aside and says, do you know what you've just done? And Emma says, I've been honest. I've just told this. You have just done something. And Jane Austen makes us feel that that moment is tantamount to the, Lear losing his kingdom morally. To hurt someone is just that bad. And yet one can't help but feel with Emma that addlepate needed to be told that she was silly and stop bothering people. And kindness was a way of just preserving her in her silliness.
Yes. I mean, it's like a moral question, isn't it? Which is, do we want to manage people or do we want to engage with them? And which is kinder? Because I think the worst kind of kindness, a very good example, the worst kind of kindness is a protection racket. I think it's much kinder to engage with somebody. I think actually it's an act of, as it were, unconscious aggression to collude with things, to go along with things that are not in the service of real exchange between people. That kindness is to do with people exchanging things with each other.
Here's a call from Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Emily has been waiting. Emily, thanks for calling. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. Thank you, and thank you for taking my call. Sure. I just wanted to address the fact that I've heard a lot of talk today about kindness and authenticity and kindness as an exception, and even the Jane Austen example, where I would not hesitate to say that there's a kind way of being frank and honest with people that is perhaps not so, doesn't put people in such a position of feeling hurt. But I have equated kindness very often, and I am accused of being too kind all too often, with respect, really. Respect for people simply because they exist. Your guest, Andrew, alluded to that earlier, that if we are literally of the same kind, why wouldn't we treat people the way that we would expect to be treated? And to me, you can interchange respect with the word kindness and come out in the same place as we are today, which I think is a very sad commentary on society and sets a terrible example for our children.
Mm-hmm. Emily, it's a good point. Thank you. Adam.
I think it is a good point. And I think that the first thing you said matters a lot, which is it's very much to do with phrasing. That it may not be a question of authenticity exactly. It may be much more a question of how people say things to each other. That there are ways of being direct or frank or engaging with people that are not simply a sort of covert opportunity to be cruel to them. And I think there are ways of being kind that are simply a straightforward engagement with somebody. But it's all the art of it is to do with the phrasing. Is the way things are said, and very often the spirit, I think, in which they're said.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing kindness this hour and whether or not there's enough of it to go around. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook as well at On Point Radio. I'm joined by Adam Phillips, co-author of On Kindness, and by On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Adam Phillips, are people more inclined to be kind when they are in crisis?
I think it cuts both ways, this. I think that trauma doesn't change people. It exposes them. It reveals things in them that were kind of latent or potential. So I think that, we can identify crises when people have become much more communal, that they've actually had to reconfigure their values and rethink them and have felt the need for a kind of solidarity. We can also think of crises like in New Orleans, when actually what's been brought out have been latent class and race hatreds. So that I think you couldn't generalize, but I think one of the things that can happen in a crisis, and I think it depends upon the kind of the culture around the crisis, is that the crisis can free people to rethink the things that matter most to them.
Let's go back to the phones in Richmond, Virginia. Vanessa is on the line. Vanessa, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. I was calling in because it sounded like some of the other callers, and just generally I think in terms of kindness, people get confused in thinking that their kind act has anything to do other than with themselves and to benefit themselves. In an ideal kind act, another individual would be benefited from that kind act. But the generation of that act and the benefit of it truly is from the person who is producing that act. And I think when people feel vulnerable, their expectation to receive something from the other person in return is what gets confusing, and I don't think that you can have that expectation. I think you need to come to terms with that it is a completely selfish act and completely ideal when it does benefit someone else. Mm.
Vanessa, thanks. Adam Phillips, needs to be a completely selfless act.
I'm not sure it has to be either selfish or selfless. I think, in a way, our preoccupation about whether acts are selfish or selfless distracts us a bit. I think the real question is whether we're moved to do it, whether we really want to do it, whether at that moment we feel for that person. Because we often, and most often, don't know why we do things. But we do know that people's suffering, and their pleasures obviously, but their suffering, has a very, very powerful effect on us. The people's vulnerability has an immediate impact. And then the question becomes how one, as it were, deals with that. Now, most people, because they find other people's and their own suffering unbearable, want a self-cure for that. And one self-cure is a kind of hardening of oneself, as if to say, my self-preservation depends upon me not being moved by this person. Hmm. Now, I think that's a tremendous cost. That would be my prejudice. Mm-hmm. So that it's not a question of whether I'm being selfish or selfless. It's a question of whether I actually feel something in that person's presence that makes me want to do something for them. Mm. It's very, very simple. I mean, one of the things about kindness is it's not a sort of special subject. It's not something we have experts on or specialists in or would need to go to university to study. We almost always know in any given situation what the kind act would be.
Mm. Yeah, and if we don't do it, boy, we feel it. Just as you were talking and listening to some of these wonderful calls, I'm haunted by something, and we're all haunted by many things, but I'm haunted by one thing in particular. I was a coach of a kids' baseball team. We had an after-season party, and everyone was having fun, and a young fellow who wasn't all that popular showed up with his mom. And the two of them were standing there alone, mom and boy. And I knew I should go over and make them feel at home. And I hesitated, and I was distracted. And finally, another coach did it. And I will carry this. Maybe it had no effect on that boy at all. But boy, do I feel it to this moment that I lost the thread of human solidarity just because I didn't want to be associated with so awkward a scene, a boy and his mom at a party where there were just boys.
Yeah, and in many acts of kindness, one has to bear with a kind of awkwardness or not quite knowing how to do things. Because I think Jack's right. I mean, acts of unkindness or failures of kindness are essentially acts of self-betrayal. Huh. There's no doubt in that situation what you wanted to do. Mm. And what you wanted to do and the right thing to do were the same. And yet something stops you. And I'm sure we can all identify with that situation. Mm. And in a way, our book is about that moment. What stops you? Why might somebody at that moment feel they can't do it when they know they can?
Let's go back to the phones. In Wellesley, Massachusetts, Ruth is on the line. Ruth, welcome. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Hi. And Adam. America is a ageist society. People are often not kind to elders who need help because they are afraid of their own aging and thus don't identify with the old and blame the old for their limitations and needs. I know this because I'm 84 years old and a gerontologist by profession, author of 9 books in the field. Hmm. What do you think about the unkind way Americans treat the aged? And I don't know if that's true in England or not, Adam.
Ruth, thank you.
Well, it's very striking, isn't it, that people are supposed to be kind to young people and people are able to be so unkind to older people. And I think very much along the lines of what you've said, I think that there is a tremendous fear of the fact of aging. And so when there's fear, there's refusal or denial or rejection. Because there are some very fundamental things, which is we've all been babies and young children. We all get ill and we all age and we're all subject to accidents. So vulnerability is absolutely the heart of the matter. There's no life without vulnerability. So your relationship to vulnerability is going to be a very fundamental way in which you organise your life. Now, if you find yourself needing to shun, in the way you've described, older people, it's as you've said, because you can't bear something of the fact that older people, like younger people, are dependent on people. Now, the naive belief, I think, in the middle of this, is that we grow up to become independent when we're no longer dependent on others. In fact, we are equally dependent on others throughout the life cycle. It's just that in old age and in infancy and childhood, it's more vividly clear that we're dependent on other people. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's always exactly the same amount of dependence. But if you live in a culture that is terrified of dependence, you live in a culture that encourages people not to be kind and not to need people to be kind to them. And the people who are going to suffer most are going to be the aging.
To Somerville, Massachusetts. Let's hear from Ellie now. She's on the line. Welcome to the program, Ellie.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to a few things that Jack said earlier, okay. Especially about his reference to Emma. The point is that Mr. Knightley makes is that Emma's honesty, she's honest and frank, but to somebody who is significantly less advantaged and privileged than she is. And so that her honesty to Miss Bates comes across as real sort of cruelty and brutality because Emma is so privileged and so wealthy, and Miss Bates is not. And I think that one thing that we need to remember is that any time that we think we're being frank and honest, if we're doing it to a person who is in some respect weaker in some way, more vulnerable, whether for whatever reason, they can experience that as real cruelty and brutality, not as kind of refreshing frankness. And sort of this, and Jack's also his comment about when he sort of didn't go and say hello to the sort of shy or awkward boy and his mother at the party. I mean, those are the moments, right, when we need to remember that sort of we are lucky and we are, you know, like Emma Woodhouse, or we're like Miss Bates. And I think that's the point of that particular moment of her honesty and not understanding how she can be cruel.
Mm. Ellie, thank you. Jack, respond.
That's so well said. I can't improve on that. Adam?
I'm not sure I can either, except to say that, you know, it's very interesting that we're still debating that scene in that novel. and that the reason that we could probably go and talk about this for a whole program is because it very much focuses the question of what would be the kind act, the assumption being that's what we want to be. Well, it raises the issue in that situation. A, do we want to be kind? Should Emma be kind? And if so, what would it be to be kind? Is she being kind by what she does, or should she have restrained herself? Now, those seem to me to be really interesting questions. Not, how can I become the richest person I know?
Back to the phones again. Anne is in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My mother was a very kind woman. She came from the Midwest to Boston, which was a tough transition. But when I was growing up, and, you know, if kids were mean or that somebody was rude, my mother always told me, kill them with kindness. In other words, you know, if somebody's rude, just be kind back. And it actually served me. I travel a lot, and I travel in countries where I don't speak the language. Mm-hmm. But I've found that, and somebody I think had said this earlier, they kind of associate kindness with respect. Mm-hmm. And I think there is something there, because I happen to like human beings because I'm one of them. And I think there is a certain respect that does have to do with kindness, because I have had to rely on the kindness of strangers mm-hmm. when I've been in some difficult situations and couldn't figure it out myself because I'm in a different culture. And the kindness of strangers has been there. And I think sometimes it's there because the way I treat them. Mm-hmm. So I think mm-hmm. that, you know, and also too, you know, just in listening to this whole conversation, I'm in my late 40s, and when I worked for a computer company, which I won't name, I had people telling me, one woman in particular, suggesting that I should be a social worker because the way I dealt with team building and let's work together and all that was really seen as a negative. I wasn't seen as aggressive and assertive. It's not even assertiveness. It was, you know, the us-them mentality that I would never play into. And in that industry, that happened to be a negative for me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it's a good point. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Alma. She's in Portsmouth, Virginia. Alma, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane. A wonderful program. I'd like to pose the point that we are so competitive and we are so sports-minded in our country. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, right from the very time a child is able to run, we get him on those sports teams. And even when they coach asks the team members to you know, go to the losing team and give them a pat on the back at the end of the game, they don't do it. They do it reluctantly. Mm. That kindness is hard to foster in a child when sports is such a big part of their life and being competitive and knocking the other girl down, almost like war.
Alma, thank you. Adam, any thoughts about how to change that, especially in our children?
Well, I think, I mean, it's very striking, isn't it, that we are now, as modern people, very mindful of how cruel children are, but very few people talk about how kind children are by nature. Mm. And, of course, you know, the assumption is if you leave the children alone, they're going to be getting up to all sorts of mischief. But, of course, what we never witness when we adults are not there is them being kind to each other. Mm. And I think children are capable of tremendous kindness to each other as well as cruelty. Now, I think I feel slightly different about sport. I think that, again, it matters. What matters is the culture of the sport goes on around, because the thing about sports is that it's aggression in which there are rules. In other words, the aggression is contained, and the spirit of the game can be not that, as it were, the people you're playing against are your enemies, that they're collaborating with you to make a competition. In other words, I think a sporting ethos doesn't have to be a terrible thing. It can actually enable people to be kind to the people they're competing with. That would seem to me a good project.
Another couple of calls here before we run out of time. Elaine is in Boston, Massachusetts. Elaine, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wanted to return to something that was referenced before about kindness in a stranger in a crisis situation and share a bit of a story. Last night I was trying to make it from New York back to Boston. The weather was horrible. All the flights were canceled repeatedly. And after many hours in the crowded airport, I finally decided I would simply rent a car. When I went to Hertz, almost all the cars were gone because of the problems. Three gentlemen from Goldman Sachs were in the line in front of me, and I'm not sure what prompted me to do this, perhaps the crisis, but I just simply said, "Can I have a ride?" And they looked at each other for a moment and said, "Sure," and put me in their car and drove me all the way back to Logan Airport, a 3.5-hour drive.
An act of kindness.
But a risky one.
Yes, well, and you know, that's what I thought afterwards. I thought, well, now what was it that prompted me, normally a cautious person, to ask a complete stranger for a ride?
But isn't this also the point?
What was it about this crisis that caused them to be willing to give me a ride?
Elaine, thank you.
But it links, doesn't it, with what the previous lady said, which is that at its best, kindness brings out the best in people. It's very clear that it actually gives people an opportunity.
Nancy is now on the line from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Nancy, welcome to On Point.
Hello. I am very much enjoying this. I consider kindness as my religion. Kurt Vonnegut and also James Joyce also said before they died, the most important thing in life is kindness, is being kind. And I try to live my day-to-day life that way. Just a point. Yesterday, I was at a restaurant. It was very, very busy, and the waitresses were really trying hard. Some people were very upset with them and were very cruel to them, and I was very kind and just told them, and my friends as well were kind, and we told them, it's all right, we understand that you're busy. And the experience was just so much better for us than the people who got upset and were not kind at all.
Nancy, thanks. Thanks so much for the call. Adam, I'm down to my last minute here. I'm just curious how your personal opinions or actions have changed as it relates to kindness since your study of kindness.
Well, I think when one becomes aware of it, rather than just taking it for granted as something that one does or doesn't do, I think it certainly made me very aware of the kind of situations that Jack described earlier, which is that of the many situations in which it would take very little to be kinder than one was. And also how haunted, as he said, we are by the acts of self-betrayal we're capable of when we're not as kind as we could be. So I think that's one bit of it. The other bit of it is how important it is for there to be a non-sentimental version of kindness. That nothing's, it's not a sort of we must try harder to be kind, so much as this is an unexplored, profound pleasure between people.
A wonderful hour, so enjoyable. Thank you to my guests, Adam Phillips, co-author with Barbara Taylor of the book On Kindness. Many thanks, Adam. Thank you.
Thank you.
On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Great perspectives, as always, Jack. Thanks.
Thank you, Jack.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook, On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.